Yeah, the Shilling Show rolls on here, and please give your full attention to the program if you have an opportunity to sit down and take all this in, because it's so critically important. David Morata joins us, the president of Morata Wealth Management, online at moradaonmoney.com. And on our continuing series, Looking Backward on Socialism, today we're talking about liberal control of academia. And, you know, this has gotten to such a critical point. David, you and I were talking earlier about our own experiences when we were in college at roughly the same time in the same era. And, you know, we might have had a few dust-ups and flaps going on, but it wasn't anything like it is today, was it?
It has gotten worse, certainly. Since the 1960s, the conservatives and libertarians have become increasingly rare in academia, to the point where the percentage of Democrats within a department or a college today averages somewhere between 83 and 96%, depending upon the institution or the department. And that just causes a lot of different biases to go on within academia and within society. And the liberal bias in academia is so overwhelming, it's nearly indisputable, and yet liberals will dispute it. They'll say, oh, no, there's not really anything. And they their progressive view is to them viewed as the norm by which all other bias is measured. Mm-hmm. And so, of course, if they're the norm, then there's an overwhelming conservative bias everywhere else. And that's right. And that's the way they view it. They're the norms by which all other of us deviants are measured.
David, let's start off with just a quick review. When we talk about looking backward on socialism, this has been a series, and I don't know if we're number five or six in this conversation, but this was based on a book, and maybe you could tell us a little bit about the background.
Yeah, originally, Looking Backwards was written in 1888, and it was a science fiction novel of the time. And in it, someone falls asleep in Boston and wakes up in the year 2000 to find we're in a socialist utopia in the United States. And it was so influential in its time that many, many different items came after it that provided the basis for socialist thought. It really moved an entire generation more socialist in the 1920s and 30s until finally in World War II, socialism sort of was... its nature was revealed, and it lost favor after World War II, but it's continued to influence a lot of socialist thought, including socialist thought within the school systems, such that a lot of the indoctrination was seen as that way. To the liberal, universal education is an essential part of the work of shaping and molding each generation to fit into the socialist whole. And so as a result, education is terribly important to socialism and to liberalism and to progressivism, because it's the means by which we will forge the socialist utopia. And anyone who stands in the way of such indoctrination is really getting in the way of their utopia. And that's why they take such a vehement anger toward those who are conservatives, libertarians, or religious.
You know, this is interesting that you bring this up, this whole issue of universal education. Of course, we have government schools, and yet they have a death grip, almost a monopoly, unless you can afford somehow to homeschool your kids as we do or send kids to a private school. They've got a death grip on the youth of the nation. And then anytime anyone tries to say anything about it, you know, somebody on the right, let's give people a choice here. You know, the attacks are vicious.
Yeah, we just had the celebration of the birth of sort of the rights within the Constitution. Mm-hmm. And my favorite right is, I think, the Ninth Amendment to the Constitution, which talks about unenumerated rights. Mm-hmm. And my favorite unenumerated rights, which we don't have because they weren't enumerated, yeah, is the right to education. The Netherlands has such a right written to their constitution, which says that any government money spent on education can be used by the parents to go to any school of their choice. And so the Netherlands is, to me, is the model of what a right to an education actually looks like. You're able to pick the kind of education you want. And if we had education choice in the United States, and I mean this very sincerely, I would be running a school. I love the academic environment. I love running a school. I love trying to help people learn. I started out my career as teaching computer science, and so I love being a teacher. I come from academia really from the inside, and I've turned most of the jobs that I do into some form of an education. I would love to run a school, and if the funding was available to run a school and I didn't have to compete with a government monopoly, mm-hmm, I think I could run a very good school, one of the top schools in the area. But that's a different life and a different set of choices. And as long as there's a government monopoly on education, I don't really think running a school and competing with that government monopoly is really what I want to do.
Maybe you could wake up in 2060.
There you go.
And have a education utopia.
Yeah.
You know what I think really exposes the fraud of the left on their government school monopoly? And, you know, we talked about the choice issue. But I hear this term repeated here locally all the time, and I'm sure that it's in different places across the country, that we have what they call a school to prison pipeline, and how we have, you know, this is some racial conspiracy or something. But if these people truly believe there was a school to prison pipeline, wouldn't the very first thing they would do would be to abolish the monopoly on government schools so that you wouldn't be funneling these people into prison?
Yeah, I would think so. And I think the reason why this is not a bigger issue is that the people who are hurt by it are traditionally lower class, the lower classes who get put in the lower school districts, and they don't have the wherewithal to be able to stand up. They also are primarily, you know, supporting a party that is entrenched with the education associations and teachers unions to maintain the status quo. So, you know, if you look at documentaries like Waiting for Superman, the school districts are really terrible and broken for most of the children that are in them. And we isolate some students from it by having advanced placement and things like that and upper tracks. And really that means the best teachers go to the best students and the lower students are really at a great disadvantage. So I would think that people who are normally Democrat supporters would be the people who would have the most to gain from supporting school choice. But so far that tilt hasn't happened.
In about a minute remaining, why do you think that's the case? Because it seems obvious.
I think there's I read a very interesting book on education, and it's because the way everything is currently structured, no matter what reforms you do in the school district, there's rubber bands to pull it back to the status quo. And what it takes is it takes this systemic change. It takes actually just breaking the system entirely and throwing it on its head and allowing everything to compete in order to have some kind of change. So they keep hoping for these incremental changes and these small changes, but because all the incentives pull it back to the norm, the changes really aren't there. If I were to try to work within the school systems, all of my work would not be mine, and it would not be under my control, and I couldn't guarantee that it would actually be done correctly. And I would be pulling against the tide and against the rubber bands. So it's just not worth it because the minute I stop pulling, I'm not gaining any ground. It just snaps back to the status quo. But I think people think that the reforms can happen within the school district. And I don't know how many years of school failures we have to have before people realize that the reforms can't be done within the current model.
We're just not spending enough money.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Exactly. Okay. Let's go to the break here. We're talking about looking backward on socialism and liberal control of academia. 977-1070 is the phone number. If you have comments, questions, or challenges, we welcome you here. Samantha stands by. Let me give you the number. It is 434-977-1070. You can get in line right now. We can take calls on the other side. We're going to talk about some very specific incidents, particularly involving the University of Virginia, and a family-related incident for David on the same topic. Really interesting history. And by the way, he's posted. Is this piece posted up at your website yet? Not, okay, it will be soon, so we'll let you know. We'll have it at shillingshow.com as well. All right, stay with us. The Shilling Show continues in a moment.
Boys, and free my soul. I wanna get lost in your rock and roll and drift away.
Shilling Show continues, looking backward on socialism. David Morata, liberal control of academia. All right, so I got to go to some of these examples that are local, and then I want to talk about the example within your own family. But at the University of Virginia, many people revere, maybe they went there and didn't have an experience like this, or they just were in a department where it wasn't so prevalent. But there are three case studies here that I'd like to get into. And the first one would have to do with the publication called Wide Awake. I'd never heard this story before. I think you said it goes back to the 90s?
Yeah, 1995. What happened was there was a Christian student publication called Wide Awake, and the university tried to withhold funding from it, saying, hey, it's a religious publication. We're not going to fund it, despite the fact that it was a student publication and you could have a student publication on any other topic, Marxism, atheism, anything else like that. The student sued and ultimately went to the Supreme Court, and it was the subject of a 1995 Supreme Court case. And they won with the Supreme Court ruling the university could not discriminate against a religious point of view. A lot of people today think, oh, well, you know, of course they can't discriminate against a religious point of view. But it was Supreme Court cases like that that actually finally won that. Up until 1995, that was not the law of the land. It was not the way universities understood things. And even today, it's not the way universities understand things. They find other reasons to discriminate against against religious activities on campus. And even if you have a Supreme Court case, it doesn't just enforce itself.
No.
It actually has to be enforced by lots of litigation in order to keep those rights active and to keep people from doing wrong. And so that's a Supreme Court case. You would think 1995 is actually really late for that to have been decided. You think that would have been decided a long time ago, but it wasn't. So that's, you know, that's an example from the 1990s of the university really kind of trying to discriminate against a religious point of view.
You know, they made some claim that it was going to be a violation of the establishment of a religion. It was really weak. And, you know, it's fascinating to me that they kind of fall back on these things as if they really believed in any of that. If that was really their guiding principle, I think they would be different on a lot of issues. But I'm glad that they were slapped down. Let's go now to a couple of people who are affiliated with faculty there. Dr. Ken Elzinga, who was a guest on this program once some years ago, so I've met him before. I know he's highly regarded.
Yeah, Ken Elzinga has a very interesting story that he tells. When he was on a tenure track at the university, he was a young professor of 25, and he was asked to speak at a Christian group on grounds. And that Christian group, unbeknownst to Ken, put up flyers all around grounds. And one of them was right at the place where a lot of his cohort and faculty members would go to eat. And one of his faculty members saw it and said, "What is this thing that you're going to? You know, you may lose tenure if you actually, you know, if that gets known in the department and stuff like that." And Ken, in a moment of moral weakness, I think, went and took the flyer down. And Ken describes that as his watershed night of the soul of thinking to himself, "Here I am. I'm, you know, I'm seemingly ashamed of my faith," and stuff like that. And in the morning, he went and put the flyer back up. But just the fact that, and in his story, I think the important point is that, you know, it's easy to deny God and it's easy to slip in your faith and stuff like that. And he didn't know whether to be more ashamed of having taken the flyer down or when he put it back up, maybe God said, "Well, maybe I can use this guy after all." You know, so you know, to him, it was a turning point where he decided he was not going to be ashamed of his faith on grounds. What's interesting to me is the fact that it was widely known and accepted both by this other professor and Ken that it might hurt his chances for tenure. If it became known that he was religious, that religious, conservative, libertarian, those are all things that are not really tolerated well at the University of Virginia. And that as far as he knows, no one ever saw the flyer, and it was not an issue in his tenure confirmation, but it was certainly a fear, at least of his and other people in the department, that it would be.
Let's go on to the next one, and this is also a person who's been a guest on the program a number of times over the years, and that would be Brad Wilcox, who does a lot of studies on sex, marriage-related topics, family topics.
Yeah, and Brad Wilcox was someone who was on a tenure track, and he was in his tenure review, as they were discussing things, a number of things were said, both about his conservative and religious viewpoints, and it was fairly nastily biased against religion and conservatism, and the vote was ultimately to deny him tenure, all in violation of university policies. But because it was also blatant, it was sort of widely known what the reasoning was. He was denied tenure. It was a few weeks where it looked like he had been denied tenure, and everyone expected that sort of to stand. When President John Castine at the time reviewed it and said, "You know, I've had enough controversies in my tenure. I just don't want another one," and overruled the committee and gave him tenure. I think the surprise in this case is two surprises. One, that it was overruled. It was one of the few cases of overruled tenure of a discrimination like this. And second, that it was so blatant that it got overruled. Had it been quiet and hidden and agreed upon ahead of time with a wink and a nod, I think he would have just been denied tenure and that would have been the end of it. But conservatives, it's widely shown, conservatives in academia have to publish more in order to receive tenure than liberals do. There's a bias against them. There's also a bias that it's harder for conservatives to get published in liberal journals because the departments of all of the review committees are so overwhelmingly progressive that it's very difficult for a conservative or religious point of view to actually make it into a journal. And this sort of brings up another case that I think is interesting. And that is that conservatives are rightly skeptical when they question scientific findings in academic journals. Because the journals are published by, 96% progressives, they aren't asking the kinds of questions that conservatives would ask. They're not doing the kinds of research that conservatives would do. And they're not reaching conclusions that conservatives would reach, even based upon similar evidence. So when you hear things like, 96% of all scientific findings support this view. Mm-hmm. All you're really saying is, 96% of progressives have progressive points of view.
Well, we hear that about climate issues all the time. Right. The science is settled because this percentage of people supports the idea.
Right.
So.
And we did our last show on the climate. What they support is that, climate change is happening and that it's at least partly caused by human activity. Well, duh. The claims they used to make back in the 1970s and 1980s and 1990s about environmentalism have all been proven false. What about those scientific claims where 96% of scientific alarmism set off alarms and none of the alarms came true? I think there's a good healthy skepticism, and until they've sort of dumbed down their conclusions, it's not really worth taking them seriously.
David, before we go to the break here, I'm really curious about somebody like Brad Wilcox or Dr. Elzinga, who's been there for a long, long time. But, once all this comes to light, what's it like to be there? I've known some conservative people on the inside at UVA, and generally they keep their heads down, way, way, way down. It would seem to me to be an ongoing thorn to deal with if you were sitting in that seat.
Yeah, there's an interesting study that was done. It's in the paper that will ultimately come out. There's an interesting study that was done, and what it found is a lot of studies sort of show that the more highly educated people are, the more liberal they are, and that's partly because they take libertarians out because they can't classify them as liberal or conservative. Mm-hmm. Libertarians, it turns out, are the smartest of all, but I'm going to sort of lay that one aside for a minute. But one of the things they found is although people who espouse to be liberal are very smart, the smartest people of all espouse to be liberal, and they're not. They're actually more conservative, which means in this age of the Twitter terror, the reign of Twitter's terror and being mocked in social media and beaten down in the university environment, the smartest people of all have a veneer of liberalism and underneath actually have very conservative values, which is a very strange thing, but I do believe it because the mono groupthink of the university environment makes it so it's very difficult to try to have any conservative views. There's a great vehemence that's done and a harm that's done against people of a conservative or religious point of view within academia. And I don't think there's some grand conspiracy. There doesn't need to be a grand conspiracy. It's just when all of the monothink is in one direction, it's very difficult to have a different opinion.
It certainly is. David Morata is our guest. 977-1070 is the phone number. We're talking about liberal control of academia and looking backward on socialism. Our final segment on this topic with an anecdote from his very own family. Just fascinating history. When the Shilling Show continues in just a moment.
And the sign said, long-haired freaky people.
Yeah, right behind the microphone. The Shilling Show continues here. It's a Turbo Tuesday dish of the program. David Morata's with us. We've got lots to talk about. The topic of liberal control of academia. Just a few minutes left. Let's go to the phones and say hello to Chris. Chris, go right ahead with David Morata.
Thank you, Rob. Merry Christmas to you both.
And to you.
I've been listening, David, and my concern for probably the past 20 years is I see it like this. The liberals used the courts to insert themselves into positions that Americans typically did not want them to get into because of their unconventional views. So they would say that you were discriminating, and they forced them their ways into our institutions. And now they're doing the very same thing. They do not want opposing views, and conservatives are not willing to use those discrimination laws. We never believed in them in the first place. And I think that's part of the problem. I mean, I don't see conservatives saying, UVA, you know, threw me off of this dais in within this institution, and, you know, I'm going to make sure it doesn't happen again. But anyway, that's one thing, one point. And another is, I think that it's very dangerous because we parents are losing the authority over their children. You know, you send your kid to school 8 hours a day, and these people just usurp their morality and their virtue that you've been trying to instill on them. And I find this also very dangerous. And I'll just hang up and listen. Thank you.
Yeah, Chris, thank you. Go ahead.
It certainly is true that that I've seen a lot of religious discrimination that did not ever result in taking legal action. I think it comes from Christians' reticence to use the court system to enforce rights. We tend to be a little bit more forgiving and a little bit less, a little bit more tolerant, actually, of opposing points of view. And, you know, so long as we ultimately sort of are accommodated in some way, we try to get along and be at peace with all people. So there is a hesitancy, which I have seen, and I think defending rights is important. And so I'm a little bit more of an advocate to take legal action, except that when it comes to me, I'm usually don't. I usually just say, okay, well, that's the way it is, and I'm just going to go someplace else, and I'm going to do my thing without you and without your support and without your, you know, accommodations and all of that. I'll just do it on my own. And I think that's also partly because conservatives and religious people have a fallen view of human nature. Mm. We kind of expect that to happen. We expect there to be kind of a disturbance. And we don't think that anyone is standing in the way of utopia because we don't think utopia is possible.
Right.
So we're much less vehement that way. So I will say, you know, there is a difference between the two worldviews, and it is correct. The liberal worldview is going to turn to the court system to try to make everything perfect. I have a brother who's a lawyer, and he says if you go to court, you've automatically lost because the court system is a terrible way of finding justice. It's just not going to do that. It's going to find something else. And there is, you know, there is sort of this discrimination that happens, but I think it's one that we just sort of tolerate and put up with.
I want to go to this because I didn't know this was in your own family history, but tell us about your dad, who's been a guest here on the program several years ago.
Yeah, my father, George Murata, was a research fellow at the Hoover Institution on the Stanford campus. He started in 1975 after retiring from government. The only thing my father's ever failed at is retirement. He's 93 and still going strong. And so he went there in 1975. In 1980, Ronald Reagan was elected president, and several of the research fellows of the Hoover Institution went to join the Reagan cabinet. Well, the Stanford faculty took offense. They were in the New York Times, and this is what the New York Times read. Liberal faculty members at Stanford are offended by the reputation of the Hoover Institution. They thought somehow the Hoover Institution's, including some conservative scholars, was an offense to their, you know, liberal control of Stanford. And pretty much they all signed petitions and made agitations for basically Stanford to take over the Hoover Institution and for their departments to take over the Hoover Institution and all kinds of things like that. And my father, who was not only a senior research fellow there, he was also the public affairs coordinator. Mm-hmm. It kind of fell to him to defend this attack. And my father, with my mother's help, he went and he did the research of all of the different departments at Stanford University and how they were registered. Because in California at that time, you had to register Republican, Democrat, or Independent. And, you know, what he found was, for example, I've got his notes here. He sent me just recently, you know, the history department had 4% of Republicans in it.
Wow.
The political science had 8%. Anthropology had 7. Sociology had 0. 0 Republicans None. In it. And he also did the same thing of the 25 Hoover Institution senior fellows. And at that time, now, bear in mind, at that time, Ronald Reagan had just won California 52.7%
mm-hmm.
to Jimmy Carter's 35.9%.
Mm.
So he had overwhelmingly won California. And this is when California was known as Reagan country.
I had one of those stickers on the back of my Honda Civic with the little outline of California
exactly
said
right.
Reagan country.
Yeah, and it's hard to believe that today because California's driven so many conservatives out of the state.
Yeah.
But that's what it was back then. Of the 25 Hoover Institution senior fellows, there were at that time 11 Democrats, 10 Republicans, and 3 political independents. So it seemed fairly representative of the state as a whole, and yet it was the university faculty that was decrying this horribly right-wing institution of the Hoover Institution. That attack pretty much went on throughout the entire, 8 years of the Reagan presidency. In 1998, they were back there again. They were demanding the firing of Glenn Campbell, who was the director of the Hoover Institution at the time. Can you imagine just, we're going to fire you because you're a conservative and because you're leading a conservative organization. And he again, so my dad again sort of tried to defend the Hoover Institution against these attacks. It ultimately resulted in the Stanford board of directors firing Glenn Campbell, and they fired him and put someone else in his place. They lost the Reagan Library because Reagan tried to put his library at the Hoover Institution, and they said, "Nah, we don't want it here. Go somewhere else, you terrible person."
Mm.
And so that's why the Reagan Library is now in Southern California. It reminds me of New York driving out Amazon or the DC area driving out Disney. It's like, we want nothing to do with conservatives or anything that doesn't smack of liberal progressivism.
We've got just about 30 seconds to wrap this up. Where do we go from here?
One of the things that I did find interesting in all of these studies is that conservatives are actually fairly happy in academia.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's because conservatives are just fairly happy in general.
Yeah.
We have an internal locus of control, and we think that we think that it's not up to us. Liberals, it turns out, are even more unhappy in academia than conservatives are, but they're kind of an unhappy lot, and they think there's more persecution against them even in academia. So it's interesting to me to see all of that. A conservative in academia certainly has a unique place. I loved my years in academia. So I would say that I would not shy away from it just because there's this bias. In fact, if anything else, it's a unique landscape where there's no one else doing that kind of work. And so you'll find it very happy and rewarding to be able to be doing conservative research and religious research within the halls of academia. It's also true that conservatives and libertarians and religious people thrive much better in the hard sciences, where there is a right answer and the right answer is known and accepted, than they do in the liberal sciences, where there's only the progressive monotheism that you have to bow down to and agree with.
Every cloud has a silver lining, and the fact that Glenn Campbell was no longer working there meant he had a terrific musical career, and we're enjoying it right now on our way out. David Morata, thank you so much. Online at Morata on money.com. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right.